Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler,
how much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary.
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me, in a courtroom, how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
MSW Media.
Thanks to Osea for supporting today's Daily Beans. Osea has been making clean and ultra-effective skincare and body care products for over 25 years. They use seaweed as their product's star ingredient. They're vegan and climate-neutral certified. Get 10% off your first order with promo code DAILYBEANS, all one word, at oseamalibu.com. And a big thanks to Splendid Spoon for supporting the Daily Beans. Splendid Spoon sends delicious plant-based meals and snacks designed to fit into your busy schedule instead of taking time out of it. Go to splendidspoon.com/dailybeans for $50 off your first box when you subscribe to the Breakfast, Lunch, and Reset plan or the Breakfast, Lunch, Dinner, and Reset plan. You'll be glad you did.
News with Swearing. Daily Beans, Daily Beans. Daily Beans, Daily Beans.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Beans for Monday, May 16th, 2022. Today, 10 people are dead after a white supremacist domestic terrorist opened fire in a Buffalo supermarket. John Eastman loses again. The January 6th committee subpoenas Meadows aide Cassidy Hutchinson for a third interview. We now know why the Department of Justice had to subpoena the National Archives for the 15 boxes of top secret documents Donald took to Mar-a-Lago. And a court finds that Alex Jones can't use bankruptcy to avoid paying restitution to Sandy Hook families in their defamation suit. I'm Allison Gill.
And I'm Dana Goldberg.
Quite a news weekend, Dana.
It was. It's a heavy news weekend, and I'm holding all the families that have been affected by the shooting in Buffalo in my heart. It's horrifying. It's horrifying, and it's horrifying that we know that the shooter was white because he was taken alive, even though he was shooting at police officers. He killed a security guard. Like, it's frustrating. It's frustrating,
yes,
to say the least.
And Associated Press refers to him as a teenager, whereas they refer to, 12-year-olds, as men with guns, as if they're black. So it's very, the language is disheartening. What's happening is disheartening. We also have, in the time it took me to finish this script and send it to you, we have another 5 people shot in Houston at a flea market.
Jesus.
And another 5 shot in Orange County in Laguna Woods at a church. Just in the last hour or so. And then, of course, we had the 21 shot in Milwaukee at the beginning of the weekend. That's four. And those are just the, you know, the larger ones. There's many more. But we're going to talk about this shooting in Buffalo because they have, you know, they've retrieved a 180-page manifesto. This is a white supremacist. This is a known terror threat in our country, the top terror threat, as a matter of fact. And just breaking as well, a Pennsylvania gubernatorial candidate, John Fetterman, has suffered a stroke.
Oh, geez.
He is at home recovering. And on Friday, Dana, we talked about the Department of Justice investigating the mishandling of the classified documents when Donald took those 15 boxes of top secret docs from the White House residence to Mar-a-Lago. And you know, I was wondering why the Department of Justice had to subpoena the National Archives for the boxes. Normally, federal agencies don't have to subpoena one another, but there is a reason for this. And CNN didn't explain it. They tried to, but they got it wrong. So we have Pete Strzok to come and tell us why there is a subpoena required in this particular instance. And we'll do that a little bit later in the show. But yeah, Dana, just absolute tragic weekend. And our love and hearts and thoughts are with these families and communities and the victims. And it's devastating. It's devastating. And I think we're just, I mean, we've all been at the end of our rope for a very long time. So we're going to talk about this coming up in the show. And with that, we do have a lot of news to get to, so let's hit the hot notes.
Hot notes.
All right, top story. The 18-year-old suspected of opening fire at a Buffalo supermarket Saturday told authorities he was targeting the Black community. And that's according to an official familiar with the investigation. The alleged gunman made disturbing statements describing his motive and state of mind following his arrest. The statements were clear and filled with hate toward the Black community. Investigators also uncovered other information from search warrants and other methods indicating the alleged shooter was studying previous hate attacks. And the revelation comes a day after the gunman killed 10 people, wounded three others at the Tops Friendly Markets store in a predominantly Black neighborhood in Buffalo. 11 of the people who were shot were Black, according to officials. The suspect was identified as a rifle-toting 18-year-old from Conklin, New York, who wrote a white supremacist manifesto online, traveled about 200 miles to the store, and live-streamed the attack. Buffalo Police Commissioner Joseph Gramaglia said Sunday the attack was a racist hate crime and will be prosecuted as such. Quote, "The evidence that we have uncovered so far makes no mistake that this is absolutely a racist hate crime. It will be prosecuted as a hate crime. This is someone who has hate in their heart, soul, and mind." Investigators are reviewing that 180-page manifesto I referred to. Was posted online in connection with the shooting. The author of the document, who claims to be, I'm not going to say his name, confesses to the attack and describes himself as a fascist, a white supremacist, and an anti-Semite. Quote, "We're obviously going through that with a fine-tooth comb and reviewing that for all the evidence it may lead us to besides the manifesto itself." And that's Erie County District Attorney John Flynn speaking to CNN's Victor Blackwell. I watched it on television. The manifesto's author says he bought ammo for some time but didn't get serious about planning the attack until January. He writes about his perceptions of the dwindling size of the white population and claims white people are being replaced by non-whites in a quote-unquote white genocide. This is, Dana, this is a great replacement theory. And this isn't new. We've heard it going back all the way to Charlottesville. And even, you know, way before that, there was a study done showing that the insurrectionists who attacked the Capitol on January 6th were doing so because of this great replacement theory. And this is a talking point from Tucker Carlson on Fox News and other prominent conservatives. Quote, "We continue to investigate this case as a hate crime, a federal hate crime, and as a crime perpetrated by a racially motivated violent extremist." And that's Stephen Belanger. He's a special agent in charge of the FBI's Buffalo field office. So they're looking at this as a federal hate crime as well. As I said on this show, we have raised the specter of replacement theory. This goes back to Charlottesville, like I said, and for us, it goes, you know, Dana, it's been around a lot longer than we have. And then, you know, they put out that the study. You don't know who you think you know who attacked the Capitol on January 6th. You don't. And that study showed that most of these folks weren't from rural red areas, right? They were from blue areas.
Yeah.
And they were afraid of this white genocide, some sort of great replacement, as it's been referred to. And that, like, you know, Dana, I mean, this is Tucker Carlson laughs about this.
He literally did and posted a picture of himself holding, I believe, the New York Times and posted a picture of him. He thinks this is funny.
Yeah. And this is the basis for Republican minority rule to bring autocracy to the United States. As we've said, wrapped in a flag, carrying a cross. And, you know, we just have to continue to push back with facts, transparency, sunlight, accountability, and of course, voting.
Absolutely. AG, thank you. I know that was not an easy story to give us to top off the hot notes. I'm moving on to Sandy Hook. There's a little bit of good news here. The Sandy Hook family's lawsuits against InfoWars host and conspiracy theorist Alex Jones for calling the 2012 Newton school shooting a hoax appear poised to resume soon. Now, that's based on agreements revealed Friday in the bankruptcy cases of some of Jones's companies. And we talked about this in a story a few weeks ago. The bankruptcy filings of InfoWars, Prison Planet TV, and IW Health last month. They delayed the lawsuits filed in Texas and Connecticut. Now, Jones has already lost the defamation lawsuits. We know that. And the filings came a week before a jury in Texas was set to begin considering how much money Jones should pay the families of victims in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. On Friday, lawyers in the bankruptcy case said that the families will be removed as creditors. This is interesting. And the InfoWars and Prison Planet TV will be removed as defendants in the Texas and Connecticut defamation cases. The state cases would then continue against Jones and his largest money-making company, Free Speech Systems, neither of which filed for bankruptcy. It was not immediately clear when those cases will resume. The lawyer's comments came during a hearing in U.S. bankruptcy court in Texas. Kyung Lee, a lawyer for Jones's companies, said the bankruptcy case will continue because they have other creditors. Now, a hearing, however, remains scheduled for May 27th on whether the bankruptcy case should be dismissed. The Sandy Hook families have questioned the legitimacy of the filings, saying that they were meant only to delay the defamation suits. And so we know that. And there's laws against it. You can't file bankruptcy to get out of, you know, these sort of federal charges. Is that not charges,
civil suits.
Thank you. Civil suits.
Yeah, civil liability. All right. Thank you for that. And yeah, Alex Jones is going to be completely broke. Next up from Betsy Woodruff Swan over at Politico. The January 6th Select Committee has again subpoenaed a former top aide to then Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, as we know, a key witness. She's already sat for two interviews with the January 6th panel, according to two people with knowledge of the situation. And the panel, this is Cassidy Hutchinson. Her, you know, her pages of her deposition were actually used in recent filings about Mark Meadows in the case to get Mark Meadows to hand over his stuff and not defy his subpoena in the January 6th committee investigation. But she declined a third interview voluntarily. That's according to one of the people. So the committee subpoenaed her and scheduled a deposition with her for next week. A spokesperson for the Select Committee and a lawyer for Hutchinson both declined to comment. As I said, the committee previously subpoenaed her November 9th and revealed last month in court filings that its investigators interviewed her in February and again in March. So they were subpoenas. The fact that they aim to bring her in for a third interview signals that the panel views her as an important witness with more information to share. It also highlights that even as the committee hearings are just a few weeks away, they're still in investigation and fact-finding mode. Hutchinson told investigators that a top Secret Service official warned Meadows that January 6th could turn violent. She also said White House counsel's office pushed back against Trump allies' legal theories, including theories promoted by members of Congress regarding election results. And both topics are key focuses for investigators. And with this new five-person Republican member of Congress subpoena, I'm wondering if that's not what they want to follow up with. But it says here, Meadows himself is just one of a few people to stiff-arm the committee. And investigators have interviewed hundreds of people so far. Trump's former chief of staff is not one of them, as we know. In December, they asked the Justice Department to bring criminal charges against Meadows for refusing to comply, but the Department of Justice has not made any such moves. Hutchinson's testimony may fill gaps that have been left open related to Meadows' role in Trump's final weeks. And, you know, of course, we know the House has filed several things in the Meadows case under seal. We know the DOJ has blocked them from getting certain things from the archives regarding Meadows. And we also know that the Department of Justice has been subpoenaing the National Archives for the last several months in a series of attempts to try to get documents, and that might have to do with Meadows as well. So a lot going on.
Thank you so much, AG. And Eastman, Mr. John Eastman, he has lost yet again, everyone. The judge in the Eastman coup emails case has granted the January 6th committee their expedited briefing schedule What that does is it's going to require everything to be filed by May 31st because the court recognizes the urgency of the committee's investigation given the pending public hearings that are set to begin June 9th. And that's less than a month away at this point. Let me just read the minute order filed by the judge over the weekend. On Thursday, May 12th, 2022, plaintiff doctor, whatever, John Eastman. I mean, if we can't, he can't. Kidding, we can. He can't. Plaintiff John Eastman submitted his final consolidated privilege log to the court and the select committee. There are now 601 documents in dispute that are subject to the court's in-camera review. Given the urgency of the select committee's investigation, the court adopts an expedited briefing schedule and orders the following. Number one, Dr. Eastman shall file his opening brief of no more than 40 pages by Thursday, May 19, 2022 at 5 p.m. Pacific time. Number two, along with his opening brief, Eastman shall file with the court and the select committee evidence of all attorney-client and agent relationships asserted in the privilege log. That John Eastman shall also provide evidence documenting any attorney-client relationships that existed with his clients. Evidence may include engagement letters, retainer agreements, or other writings. The evidence shall confirm the timing and scope of each attorney relationship and each agent relationship, including specific named lawsuits if applicable. If there is no written documentation, the court will accept a sworn statement from an attorney, a client, or agent in each relationship attesting that written documentation does not exist and specifying the timing and scope of the relationship.
Can you imagine, like, if Eastman called you up and was like, hey, could you sign a thing saying that I was your lawyer right before the insurrection? Would you say, yeah, sure? No, I would not.
No, I'd be like, you're on your own, John. Yeah, dear John. Number three, the select committee shall file its responsive brief no more than 60 pages by Thursday, May 26th, 2022 at 5 p.m. That's Pacific Standard Time, if anyone's curious. Number four, John Eastman shall file his reply brief of no more than 20 pages by Tuesday, May 31st at 5 p.m. And number five, both parties' briefings shall address higher level objections that apply to a substantial number of documents, as well as document-specific objections. Both parties shall argue whether the documents in question are subject to the court's reasoning in its previous order on January 4th through 7th, 2021's documents.
Yeah. And I'm sorry to stop you right there, but what that means, both parties shall argue whether the documents in question, these new documents that you say are, you know, covered by privilege, are subject to the court's reasoning in its previous order, meaning are they subject to the crime fraud exception or anything else that we already decided, right? So that's kind of what that means.
I love when you interject it. And I don't mean say dumbing this down, but for a lot of us, including myself, as I read this, I'm like, okay, that's a little confusing, but you always jump in and clear it up. And this is why we work well together. Yes, the parties may cross-reference or restate arguments made in their previous briefings for the January 4th through 7, 2021 documents, if appropriate. And to continue, if Dr. Eastman does not find additional briefing necessary, he should notify the court by Friday, May 13th, which has passed, 2022, at 10 p.m. Pacific time. Otherwise,
yeah, he filed nothing.
Didn't do it. Otherwise, the court will proceed with the above schedule, which is what's happening. Now, given the high volume of pages, the court will begin its in-camera review of the 601 contested documents immediately.
Huh. And so what that means is the judge is like, look, you can argue as to whether, you know, whether you think any of these 601 documents should go or stay or be privileged or whatever. Send me your arguments. You have until May 31st to go back and forth a couple of times. I'm going to start reviewing them now anyway, just because that's a lot.
Exactly.
And so I'm gonna review them. I'm gonna get ready, and then I'll hear your arguments. So the judge isn't even saying you can argue to stop me from reviewing them. He's saying I'm gonna go ahead, but if you have good reason for them to be stopped, let us know. And also, your privilege log still sucks, so you need to tell us all of your attorney-client relationships. Send us the letters, the engagement letters. If you don't have any, you can get them to sign the affidavit saying, you know, that they were, or show us through communications that, you know, it's clear that you were representing them. Any cases, any litigation you were thinking about might, you know, that you might happen under a work product privilege. Just argue your case, but I'm going to start looking at this shit now.
And they give them so many different options for stuff. My God.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I absolutely love it. Now, of course, John Eastman asked for a bunch of stuff. I need discovery from the committee. I need more time. I request time to discuss things with the committee. Judge blew past all that. No, bro. turn in everything by May 31st. I'm going to already start looking at this shit. Have a nice day. And I think it's absolutely fantastic that of all the things requested by both the House committee and John Eastman, the only thing that was granted here was the committee's recommended expedited briefing schedule. Yeah. So, yeah, sorry, tough shit, Eastman. So I'm interested to know, because in that batch of the January 4th through January 7th emails, you know, only one of them was subject to crime fraud exception for attorney-client privilege, just one.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to do with Rudy Giuliani. And now there's 601 more. And the House seems to think that 135 of these documents are subject to crime fraud exception, probably under the same thing. So it's going to be
a lot. Yeah.
Going to be interesting to see how that turns out. I'm looking forward to it. So that is the bulk of the news today. There was a lot more. We're probably going to have to bump to tomorrow, like Madison Cawthorn. Everyone hates him, and including Republicans, and they're probably going to gang up on him if he wins his primary this week. All sorts of other things going on in the news, but we really need to get these top stories out. This has just been a very, very difficult weekend in the news. So up next, I'm going to be discussing with Pete Strzok, our friend Pete Strzok, former FBI special agent, you know, worked on the Mueller investigation, worked on the Anna Chapman investigation, worked on the Hillary Clinton email investigation, as a matter of fact. We're going to talk about the Department of Justice investigation into the 15 boxes of classified material taken to Mar-a-Lago and why the Department of Justice had to subpoena the National Archives for the boxes and didn't just like walk over and say, hey, buddy, we're in the same administration. Can I just have those boxes, friend? Because that's what happens all the time from federal agency to federal agency. You just go and get shit. You're in the same administration. But they subpoenaed them this time. And there's a very, very good reason that no other mainstream media outlet is talking about except right here on the Daily Beans. And we'll get that from Pete Strzok after this. Stay with us.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Hey, everybody, you know I am such a busy person, and there is simply no time for shopping, prep, meal planning, and cooking. My schedule simply doesn't allow for it. There's no space for all the things you need to do to make healthy meals at home. But luckily, there's an easy way to fix this and get straight to the good part with great meals that require no prep whatsoever. It's Splendid Spoon. They send delicious plant-based meals and snacks right to your door. It's ready-to-eat food designed to fit into your busy schedule instead of taking time out of it. Splendid Spoon fits right into your schedule with a meal plan for everyone. Every meal is customizable, so you will get what you want every time. Meals are shipped ready to eat, so all you have to do is hit the button on your microwave. Every single meal is 100% plant-based, gluten-free, and GMO-free, always made with vegetables, legumes, healthy fats, whole grains, and spices from all over the world. Healthy and easy. Can't beat it. They've got plenty of smoothies, grain bowls, soup bowls, and noodle bowls for you to discover. I've been having smoothie cravings a lot lately. I think it might be the weather changing or something. My new favorite is their dragon fruit berry smoothie. It is a tropical smoothie with a perfect balance of tart and sweet. It's refreshing, just like me. They have 20 smoothies to choose from, and I plan on trying them all. They're so good. Try Splendid Spoon today and take meal planning off your plate. Just go to splendidspoon.com/dailybeans for $50 off your first box when you subscribe to the breakfast, lunch, and reset plan or the breakfast, lunch, dinner, and reset plan. That's splendidspoon.com/dailybeans for $50 off. And today's show is also brought to you by Helix Sleep. If you want to have a productive and successful day, you need a good night's sleep. Without the rest, you're likely to be cranky. Your response time is slower. You might even say something you regret just because you're tired. I used to be tired all the time. I had night sweats. I couldn't sleep. I would toss and turn and I'd feel up cranky and achy. It was terrible. And that's when Helix Sleep came to the rescue. They have a quick 2-minute online sleep quiz that matches your body type and sleep preferences to the mattress that is perfect for you. So why would you keep sleeping on a mattress made for someone else? Helix knows every body is different, and they have a selection of mattresses for everyone. They have plus-size mattresses for plus-size sleepers, soft, medium, firm, side sleeper mattresses, temperature-regulating ones if you get too hot at night. My perfect mattress is the Helix Midnight, because I'm a side sleeper and I like a medium firm mattress. It's such an upgrade over my old mattress. It's perfect. I fall asleep fast. I sleep through the night, and I wake up feeling refreshed. Now, Helix is amazing, but don't take my word for it. 12,000 five-star reviews. And 2020, they were awarded Best Overall Mattress Pick by GQ and Wired Magazine. Helix has also been recommended by multiple leading chiropractors and sleep doctors as a go-to solution for improving your sleep. So if you're looking for a mattress, go to helixsleep.com/dailybeans. Take the quiz, order the mattress that you're matched to. The mattress comes right to your door, shipped for free. You get to try it for 100 nights without risk. They will even come pick it up for free if you don't like it, but you will love it. Helix has financing options and flexible payment plans, too. And right now, for listeners, Helix is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders and two free pillows at helixsleep.com/dailybeans. That's helixsleep.com/dailybeans for up to $200 off and two free pillows. Hey, everybody, welcome back. Happy to be joined today by former FBI special agent, friend of mine, Pete Strzok. Hello, Pete. How are you?
Hey, Allison. I'm good.
Good. I'm glad. And the reason I wanted to have you on today is because I noticed a little tidbit in some New York Times reporting just a couple of days ago, I think it was on Thursday or Friday, about, well, first of all, the big news is that we've learned without a doubt that the Department of Justice is investigating the mishandling of those 15 boxes taken by Donald Trump from the White House to Mar-a-Lago. And but there was a little bit of weird sort of reporting in there that's not been clear. Some people have sort of glanced over it. I think CNN mentioned it, but didn't give a very specific reason as to why this happened. But let me read to you from the New York Times reporting. It says, in recent days, the Justice Department has taken a series of steps showing that its investigation has progressed beyond the preliminary stages. Prosecutors issued a subpoena to the National Archives and Records Administration to obtain the boxes of classified documents, according to two people familiar with the matter. Now, the thing that stood out to me, I mean, first of all, hooray, they're finally investigating this, because it says within recent days, the Justice Department has issued the subpoena to the National Archives. But that they issued a subpoena stuck out to me because I've worked for the government for a very long time. And usually when you have interagency records requests, subpoenas are not necessary. And so I had asked the question, I posed the question on Twitter, didn't really get a clear answer until I spoke to you. And so can you tell us why you would need a subpoena from the Department of Justice to get something from the National Archives?
Yeah, it's a good question. And generally, you're absolutely right. I mean, the executive branch doesn't tend to issue subpoenas or search warrants on itself if any investigating agency needs records. In my case, you know, what I know is the FBI. But if we needed information from Department of State or the CIA or whoever it was, we'd just send a letter saying, you know, please give us this stuff. And typically, they would turn that over if they had that material lawfully in their possession. You wouldn't have to, the executive branch doesn't issue, again, you don't need a subpoena because it's all under the president.
Yeah. And sometimes, though, even though sometimes U.S. attorneys will need something from evidence files from the FBI that, you know, from a case that didn't stem from how that evidence was obtained in the first place. And in that case, they just need a search warrant. So I thought that the subpoena was weird.
Yeah. And that's, you know, there are a couple of points to that. One, I saw some in the same your Twitter thread, but others, people saying, oh, you need a subpoena to get the evidence. Well, you don't have to have a subpoena to get evidence. You can collect, like if we were to ask, say, for example, the Department of State, as we did for former Secretary of State Clinton's records, they provided information that material became evidence. We didn't need a subpoena isn't needed to, you know, quote unquote, officially make something evidence. When you obtain information, you know, that is the evidence. If you took it to trial, you might need a custodian of those records from the Department of State to say, yes, in fact, you know, I'm the system administrator. I made the copy of this information on this date. This is how I did it. But you don't, evidence is not predicated, or it isn't required that you have to have a subpoena or search warrant to obtain evidence. But, you know, sometimes there are things, you know, it might be that, you know, if there was something that was held, you know, you're going into somebody's office where they have an expectation of privacy, you might need a search warrant if you're going into a Department of State office in the middle of the night or at 3 p.m. and you're looking for evidence. That might, if the person in, you know, that employee has a desk which they lock with their own lock, there might be an argument with the lawyers that there's an expectation of privacy in that locked drawer, and you might want to go to a judge and get a search warrant to get you in there lawfully. So, you know, there are a bunch of reasons you might want a subpoena to search warrant, but generally, you're absolutely right. There is that request. But I mean, there are probably many different types of exceptions, but a very notable one is when it comes to presidential records. And there's something called the Code of Federal Regulations, or CFR for short, which lays out in particular all the rules and regulations around presidential records. And it kind of has two broad paths. One is the archivist, the National Archivist, maintains presidential records during the pendency of an administration. So while somebody is the president, they are sending off the records that he or she makes to the archivist at some regular interval, and the archivist is maintaining that. And then once they are after, they're no longer the incumbent, either after the first or second term, then there is, according to CFR, the sort of automatic 5-year restriction on the information. And what that means is if you or I were to go through a Freedom of Information Act and request it, there's a kind of off limits for 5 years. And there are several exceptions to that. One is if the incumbent president says, I need this information to do my duties, that's an exception. The second thing is if the archivist is presented with a valid subpoena or search warrant. The third is if Congress and the conduct of their duties needs it. And there's a fourth, which I forget. But the point is, it's all laid out. And so what we saw, you know, according to that New York Times article, is the government going, the FBI and DOJ in this case, getting a subpoena to take to the archivist to get those documents, those presumed 15 boxes worth of documents, to obtain that as part of an investigation. And, you know, you're absolutely right. The fact that you can't get a subpoena without an active and open investigation. So if there's subpoenas being issued, that tells you that, yes, there absolutely is an ongoing investigation. The FBI doesn't do civil investigations. That means it's a criminal investigation. And they went and they did this because that is how, that's the only way, or one of the only ways that the archivist can do it. You know, theoretically, could President Biden, under that first category, say, as the chief executive in charge of all these groups, including DOJ, I need this for my duties? I mean, arguably, he might do it. But given that second, you know, kind of exception very specifically for criminal or civil cases, getting a subpoena is the logical way to go.
Yeah, that, and it's a criminal investigation into a former president. I mean, you want to put as much, slap as much due process on this as you possibly can.
Yeah. And again, it's like, I don't think, I would be very surprised if the case was focused. I would be surprised if it were a case on Trump. I think it is a case on the classified information. And what, you know, what the Bureau, I hope, is seeking to determine is, you know, yeah, A, was this in fact classified information? It sure looks like it was. You know, but two, you know, why was it there? You know, was, did anybody give authority to, was it declassified? Was there any, you know, sort of consideration given to, like, you know, hey, did President Trump before leaving say, I want to take all these things that are classified and I'm giving myself authority to do it, and I'm setting up the skiff at Mar-a-Lago where I'm going to keep it and maintain it, and the current administration blessed it, which I none of that, I won't go out on a limb and say none of that occurred. I think he just shoved it in a box because it was in the residence. But then the question is, did Trump even know it was there? Did a couple of movers go up into the residence of the White House and just say, you know, like, everything in here, shove it in a box and take it down to Mar-a-Lago? And, you know, the movers come in and they're just throwing it all in boxes, and nobody really understood that they're putting, you know, and again, it's 15 boxes. It's not a little folder where you take out 30 pages. It's 15, you know, presumed, you know, I don't know how many, you know, if a ream of paper, you know, how many reams of paper can you fit in a box? But that's a lot of classified information. But, you know, the investigation, though, will seek not only just, it's not going to be just an investigation of President Trump. I mean, he will be part of the investigative considerations, but it's going to be all these other things about, you know, who packed it, where, what's the classified information, where did it come from, who left it with Trump, what did he say about it, did he know he had it, did he know it was classified, who handled it at Mar-a-Lago, where was it stored at Mar-a-Lago, who had access to it at Mar-a-Lago. You know, inevitably, if this investigation is done well, somebody's going to have to schlep down to Mar-a-Lago investigator and go through it and say, okay, you know, where was this? Who else has access to this space? Who had access to this space? Anybody see people, including President Trump, with this information? Was he waving it around at the dining room, you know, showing people all the satellite imagery like he did, you know, the Japanese prime minister or whatever? But there will be a lot going on, and it won't be solely focused on President Trump.
No, right. I mean, the Times article lays that out. You know, they're going to be talking to all of the people who packed up those boxes, anyone who was in proximity to them at Mar-a-Lago, et cetera. I mean, it's a big investigation. It's a lot to cover. Something else you and I talked about. I mean, this is good news in that they're looking into it. But why now? I mean, the Times article said it wasn't until recent days when the subpoena was issued to the National Archives. And the National Archives didn't even tell the Department of Justice about it, allegedly, until like January of this year, a year after these documents were moved or allegedly mishandled or potentially mishandled. My gut says they were. But, you know, again, who mishandled them is under investigation. You know, one thing that stood out to me in this article is that they said, yeah, this was recent days that this one went out, that this particular subpoena went out. But they also said, and they just sort of buried this in you know, paragraph 19 of this New York Times article, that this subpoena is one of a series of requests that the Justice Department has made to the National Archives for records from the Trump administration in recent months. And if they didn't ask for what's in the boxes until recent days, what else have they been seeking from the National Archives and the Trump administration? So they're investigating something else, it seems, and they didn't really talk about that, or maybe they didn't ask any follow-ups on this series of requests from the National Archives, and they didn't say whether they were subpoenas or not.
Yeah, and my sense is that, one, I think this all came about not through a leak from the Department of Justice. This came about through a some sort of leaker discussion through Trump or his attorneys to the New York Times, trying to get a hold of the story and try and mold it in a way that's favorable to them. I mean, typically, you know, that was all the time of the Mueller investigation. It wasn't anybody on Mueller's team that was leaking. It was all these other attorneys and people who are being subpoenaed in the grand jury or who are being served with search warrants or whatever. They or their attorneys trying to shape it. And I think this is probably the same thing. But to your question, I mean, my sense is kind of the most immediate thing that leaps to mind is trying to get information out of the archives about January 6th and any sort of records that Trump may have had with communications, you know, the 20 billion torn up post-it notes that Mark Meadows was passing him or whatever it may be, that was the first kind of highest priority. But I do, you know, I'm concerned because you're right. You know, this was packed up in January 2021. We're in May of 2022. So, you know, that's 16 months later. I have never doubted, and we've talked about this before on your podcast, I don't doubt that DOJ is fearless and will go where they need to go. I don't doubt that they are not scared of going up to the president if it takes it. I'm really worried at what seems to be a lack of urgency. And that's not, again, these records, the archives has them. They're not going anywhere. They're not going to be destroyed. But at the same time, you know, and you know this, having been in the government, there's no bigger, slower bureaucracy than the United States government. And if you are not constantly approaching your job with a sense of urgency and with a sense of immediacy, things that should take a month will take 6 months. And so if there isn't this constant pressuring of we need it, we need it, we need it, things will inevitably take a long time. Now, will this all get done? I hope so. Is it going to be much harder to get done if the House and Senate flip and all of a sudden they're doing everything in their power to gum up the works of DOJ? Yes. Is it going to radically change in 2024? Potentially, yes. And so if people aren't going into work every day with a sense of, you know, this urgency every single day, it could be problematic. And I am worried that, you know, when the archives sort of flags this for the administration this January, that we're now in mid-May, and this seems to be the first sort of like movement to get these documents. That's a long time. And it's not particularly complicated. And it isn't actually even that politically difficult. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. You know, this happens. We've done it in the past. Cases like this, the FBI and DOJ have done, certainly with Secretary Clinton. It's a pretty straightforward, easy, defined path. And I'm a little concerned of how long it's taken to get to where we are.
Yeah. And tell me a little bit before I let you go about sort of the handoff between U.S. attorneys, maybe, and how that impacts investigations. Because as we know, it was back around January timeframe when Graves, who's the U.S. attorney over at D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office, brought in a guy named Windham, I think from Delaware, to run a second team. And now they have teams at the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office looking at January 6th, one looking at the boots on the ground folks, and one at the conspiracies and higher up stuff, like the more politically charged stuff. And that's Windham's grand jury. And then this New York Times article says that this grand jury has been meeting daily now for quite a while. We hadn't heard that. Like you said, we generally don't hear about that until leaks come from squeaky people who get called in to testify or get subpoenaed or want to sort of get out ahead of the story. And we know Graves didn't get there until November for whatever reason, whatever's going on in the Senate. And so it doesn't seem to me, I mean, Sherwin fucked up a lot of shit, but it doesn't seem to me like you would need to wait until you get your own U.S. attorney in that office, in that desk, to start setting up a second grand jury to look at the conspiracies and hire Oath Keepers and up. Do you know what I mean? So I'm kind of curious as to, has that ever happened? I mean, I guess if you have an old incumbent, terrible, you know, guy who squawks on 60 Minutes and tries to fuck up your entire conspiracy case, that, you know, maybe you wait until the next guy gets there, but it seems like a weird thing to wait a year to start.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, it isn't strange to me that they would bring somebody in to manage components of it and split up the responsibilities because it's so large. I mean, you know, and it was way back when Garland, Attorney General Garland testified, you know, it was probably 6 months ago at this point. And he was even then saying, this is among the biggest. It's like, fuck, no, it is without question the biggest.
Yeah, we talked about that.
And anybody should have been able to see the writing on the wall from January 8th that when we said, okay, we're going to prosecute all these people, and look at all these folks involved, without question, it should be immediately apparent to everybody that this is the scope of something that has never, ever, ever been done by the FBI or DOJ. And so again, I don't fault, and I think it's probably smart, you know, presuming you can coordinate, you can get too many chefs in the kitchen, but you would want to bring in a lot of resources. But again, that question of what is the sense of urgency there? Because, you know, you can't rush justice, but at the same time, you know, it will go slower than it needs to go. And when you are looking at things like, you know, it shouldn't be politicized, but the fact of the matter is this was an insurrection. The fact of the matter is people were trying to upend the legitimacy of the 2020 election. There's every indication when you look around that all these efforts are going on to do the same in 2022 to get ready for 2024. And so if you have criminal behavior, on the one hand, you can say, well, we're just going to be on an ivory tower and we're going to pursue this criminal justice independently at the pace it normally takes. You could make that argument. But if you are facing what I believe to be an existential threat to the operation of our democracy, you can't just sit there and say, well, this is the way our judicial system has evolved over the past 50, 60 years, 200 years. When you're facing this uniquely different insurrection, you need to be on the sort of emergency footing with that same sort of prioritization, with that same sort of urgency. And I don't know, I am worried occasionally when I see things like this, every time I see these big delays, that just adds to my worry that the appreciation, or at least how that urgency is or isn't being valued, gives me some concern. And, you know, to that point, you know, going back to the CFR and these records, from the moment of the subpoena, if you look at CFR, Trump has 30 days to object. So the archivist, the way it works, again, you know, if your listeners can go dig up CFR, I think it's 1236, 1270, I think. From the time the archivist gets the subpoena, he notifies Trump. Trump has 30 days to object if he wants to object. And then after, if he does object, up to that 30th day.
He will object.
I don't know.
You don't know?
I mean, it's kind of a little bit of a trick bag for him. I mean, he said, oh, I'm completely cooperative. I'm doing everything that the government wants. I have nothing to hide. You know, he, again, he routinely speaks out of both sides of his mouth. So it wouldn't surprise me if he objected on the 29th day. But if he wanted to drag it out, he waits until the 29th or 30th day after he's been notified by the archivist. He then does it. And then Biden gets 30 days after that to determine whether or not he's going to overrule or sustain Trump's objection. Now, if he overrules it,
Trump can also sue, right?
I assume. I don't know how that would play out. I mean, I'm sure he could try. His current bunch of attorneys don't go so well.
Yeah, well, we've already had a ruling from the Supreme Court. Yeah, saying, you know, we've already got a Supreme Court ruling. So.
Right. And then, you know, DOJ could still go to a judge then. I mean, this is just a grand jury subpoena, and they could ultimately go and get an order that couldn't be challenged. And that talks about like a final order from a court that can't be, isn't subject to challenge, is also in there. But the point being is, you know, until that 30 days goes, DOJ and the FBI aren't going to get anything. And then, you know, depending on what Trump does or doesn't do, it may be even further down the road. But again, all this is doing is there's a chunk of investigation that has to be done. All this does is push that out into the future, pushes that out closer to 2022, pushes that out, well, we're in 22, I mean, to the elections, pushes that out closer to 2024. So, you know, a delay may or may not be great at this point. And inevitably, there are going to be things going on, you know, throughout the summer, leading into the fall, leading into election season. Now, this isn't obviously a presidential election year, but, you know, if Trump's wrapped up and, you know, there ends up, there's all, you know, scores and scores and scores of highly classified material there, and there's debate about whether or not to charge somebody, that will have an impact on potentially the congressional midterms.
Yeah. And I still think that they would probably employ that 60-day rule, even if he's not on the ballot. He is certainly the leader of one of the parties that is part of the election. And then finally, was talking about charges are seem unlikely because of that high bar of intent that you have to prove. I mean, we went through this with the Hillary Clinton emails. Yes, she mishandled a couple of classified documents on a private server, but did she intentionally, you know, skirt these laws and mishandle this classified information for, you know, corrupt purposes? No, you know, so of course, Comey thought it was cool to come out and tell everybody about it 11 days before the election. But regardless, I don't know. I think everyone's like, oh, cool, he's finally going to go to jail. And there's a provision in the statute that says you can't run for public office again if you're convicted of this particular, you know, one of the records mishandling statutes or something. I kind of want to temper everybody's expectations on where this investigation might go. Because like you said, first of all, it's not just a target of Trump. They're looking at how these he's part of it. About how these documents were handled or what was done with them. But I mean, he would have had to have done some egregious, corrupt shit with these documents in order to be prosecuted.
Yeah, and I think it's too early to to tell. You're right. I mean, there's a bunch of weird, because everything Trump is weird. You know, some of it is, at least the New York Times reporting is like, all this stuff wasn't out of the Oval Office. It was all out of the residence. Well, most presidential business, you know, goes on in the Oval Office in the West Wing, and that's where the paper stays on the classified. So what was he doing dragging back 15 boxes worth of classified information to, you know, sit in his bed and eat Big Macs and watch Hannity and, you know, stare at whatever it was that was classified that he brought back? So there's one question about why was all that stuff there in the residence, not in the Oval Office, if that's accurate. You know, there is the point that because this was subpoenaed, you get grand jury secrecy that attaches to that. It's called 6E, which is a rule that when material is returned for a subpoena, it is protected with a confidentiality clause that means that the government can't share it. It's, you know, if you were to go FOIA it, it's, you know, it's called 6E material that's a response to grand jury. So, you know, kind of perversely, the fact that this material is being obtained via subpoena makes it easier for the government to get, but harder for the government to disclose to the public, either if the government wanted to or if the public tried to get it through a FOIA. And then kind of the final point is, I just don't, you know, Trump, you're right that intent is almost always one of the hardest things to prove. But again, when you look at Trump, I mean, pick whichever one of the dozens and dozens and dozens of campaign events and other statements he made where he was saying Hillary Clinton should be locked up because of the way she mishandled classified information. If you or I had done the same thing, we'd be in jail. I mean, the man was a walking advertisement for mishandling classified information is against the law and you should go to jail if you do it. Mm-hmm. And he said that. Again, if you're a prosecutor trying to demonstrate intent, you just show the jury, you're like, I'm going to show you 30 clips of him saying this, and they're, you know, two times that. So I think intent-wise, this is one area where I think Trump would be very hard-pressed, given his public statements, to say that he was not aware that mishandling classified information was a crime. Now, I'm sure he will claim, oh, I was the president, this was all my information, I was allowed to have it, I thought I didn't know I needed to declassify it. I mean, I'm sure he'll have, you know, 50, you know, kind of cottage brain or cottage cheese brained ideas about, you know, what his rationale was for why he should have been able to have it. But there's a lot that needs to, before we even start getting to the point of discussing whether or not the charges, you're right. People shouldn't get their hopes up for any sort of immediate answer. And the same thing. You know, I saw a lot of people getting particularly excited about, oh, there's a grand jury. No, there's one grand jury subpoena, one. And typically, you know, so your listeners who may not have, you know, worked in law enforcement or DOJ, getting a subpoena is easy. Like, as an agent, I go to the AUSA, I say, hey, will you get a subpoena to Citibank for this account number? They turn around and they cut, the AUSA cuts that subpoena. I mean, it gets filed with the court with the grand jury, but, you know, essentially it's done. So this is a very easy, fast administrative thing. This is not, you know, to your point of these, the grand juries and panel meeting on a daily basis for the January 6th investigations. This isn't that. I mean, from what has been reported, at least, this is one subpoena, which is nothing. I mean, that's easy. So, you know, if we see later reporting that, oh, a grand jury is issuing subpoenas for witnesses to come in and testify, that means something. Mm-hmm. That's meaningful. That really means that this has picked up steam and is really engaged in very significant work towards a criminal prosecution. But a subpoena, nobody should be getting particularly fired up about, you know, the end for Trump is not, because it doesn't.
I'm just glad it's under investigation. You know, as we've said, it would and should be. Of course, you know, we had the, they'll never look at it. They don't care. You know, no, they are. Okay. But maybe a little late, but they are. I'm also more interested in that series of records requests from the National Archives from the Department of Justice over the last few months, especially considering it's been over the last few months that Meadows has been under investigation for misdemeanor contempt, probably other stuff too. But, you know, I'm just speculating. We'll see. I appreciate your time today. Thanks for going over what, you know, why the subpoena was necessary. I couldn't find that answer, so I appreciate your time today.
Yeah,
and everybody needs to check out the book Compromised if you haven't. When's the paperback? Is the paperback out?
Paperback's out. Yeah. So go pick it up. Nice, easy to pack. Take on your summer vacation and read. And
it's a nice lighthearted romp.
Super rat. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Laugh, cry, yeah, be moved.
I absolutely love your book. Thanks so much for talking to us today, Pete Strzok.
Yeah, of course.
Stick around. We'll be right back with the good news. Hey, everyone. Spending time on yourself is so important, and I've been making personal care a priority this year, which is why I started using Osea, the amazing cult favorite skincare line. Osea has been making clean and effective, wonderful skincare products for over 25 years, spa quality stuff. They have award-winning cleansers and serums and face moisturizers.
And they're known for creating incredible body products like their famous body oil, which I love. It makes it brightens up my tattoos. It makes my skin glow. It's wonderful. Osea is a woman-run company. It's been creating clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet since 96. And they've really taken it to the next level with Osea's new body butter. It's softening, nourishing, and it has the most amazing citrus scent. It's even clinically proven to moisturize skin for up to 72 hours. I use this every day, and I can't imagine going without it now. Its rich texture feels so good. It's got such a lively scent. It applies smoothly. It's not sticky. And it makes my skin look so moisturized and healthy. A little really does go a long way as well. It's great value. Since I've started using it, it's helped my skin feel hydrated and smooth, giving me extra boost of confidence and comfort. It's been the perfect addition to my daily skincare routine, and you need to try it for yourself. Find your new skincare and body care favorites at oseamalibu.com and get a special discount just for listeners. You get 10% off your first order site-wide with promo code DAILYBEANS, all one word, at oseamalibu.com. You'll get free samples with every order, and orders over $50 get free shipping. You're going to want it all, so go to oseamalibu.com and use code DAILYBEANS. And today's show is also brought to you by Allform. If you've been listening to the show, you've heard me talk about my Helix sleep mattress and how much I love it. And I'm excited to tell you, Helix has gone beyond the bedroom to start making sofas and love seats and chairs. They've launched a new company called Allform. They're making premium customizable stuff for your living room, shipped right to your door, fast. They make beautiful furniture at Allform. It's easy to put together. It's easy to customize. They use premium materials at a fraction of the cost of traditional stores. They deliver to your home fast and free. Allform takes just 3 to 7 days in the mail. And it comes with a forever warranty, literally forever, so you know your furniture is going to last. You pick your fabric, which is spill, stain, and scratch resistant. You pick the color of the legs, the sofa size, and the configuration to make sure it's perfect for you and your home. They've got armchairs and love seats all the way up to 8-seat sectional, so there's something for everyone. And you can always start small and add seats later if you want. Your Allform sofa could grow and change with you when you move. You never know when you might need a bigger sofa. It's awesome. I chose a 3-seater sofa in whiskey-colored leather with walnut legs. It goes perfectly in my living room. It's comfortable. It looks great. It's great for the pod pets. Setup only took about 10 minutes. I can't wait to start showing it off. And if getting a sofa without trying it in-store sounds a little risky, you don't need to worry. You get 100 days to decide if you want to keep it. And if you don't love it, they'll come and pick it up for free and give you a full refund. Zero risk. So to find your perfect sofa, check out allform.com/dailybeans. And right now for listeners, Allform is offering 20% off all orders at allform.com/dailybeans. Everybody, welcome back. It's time for the good news.
Who likes good news? Everyone? Then good news, everyone.
Good news. And if you have any good news, corrections, confessions, a new good news theme song, about 10 to 15 seconds long, send it in.
Yes.
A pod pet tax photos. If you have adoptable pets in your area, anything you want to send us, you can do it at dailybeanspod.com. Click on contact. I want to thank one of our patrons, Dana. I got a postcard in the mail, and this is from the United Nations Refugee Agency. And one of our patrons made a donation in the name of the Daily Beans for $1,000 to this refugee agency.
That's amazing. Amazing.
Thank you so much to that person. And we do have a lot of good news, which is going to be really necessary after this weekend. So I'm going to kick us off, Dana, with a submission from James. Pronouns he and him. Tiny correction of cosmic import.
Ooh.
I'm assuming I made a mistake about the black hole.
Actually, I did. And I read this and I'm fascinated by it. So I don't mind the correction. Please continue.
All right. Cool. Thanks for including the Event Horizon Telescope results in today's news. As a science geek, I was all ready to run over here to correct Dana on the center of our universe. Good job, AG, on catching that. I do have one more minor correction, though. The black hole's name is Sagittarius A, with an asterisk after the A, and pronounced Sagittarius A star, even though that's not a star. The A means it's the brightest radio object in Sagittarius, and the asterisk is actually a pun. In atomic physics, you mark that an element is in an excited state, has extra energy, by adding an asterisk. Robert L. Brown, the astronomer who realized that the radio object in Sagittarius could be a black hole, renamed the source from Sagittarius A to Sagittarius A asterisk to indicate how exciting a discovery it was. How fucking cool.
A star. Sagittarius A star. I love it. I love learning new things.
I know. That's awesome. I was gonna comment on the asterisk too, but I just didn't.
I did. I was going to too, and I went with it, and no, neither of us said anything. So we can usually count on James. You know a lot about a lot, James, by the way. So I love it. I love it.
Yes, he does. And yeah, because I was looking at the A star, and I was like going to make a butthole joke or something, and then I just didn't, for obvious reasons, because it's not funny.
Sometimes we know people.
I have some updates. Sometimes I'm just pretty. I have some updates on Cobalt, the mini Aussie, and her sister, Denim. Cobalt is fully recovered from her cancer and vestibular syndrome. Wonderful. Unfortunately, both of them are getting old, and they're showing early signs of kidney disease. However, they're both in very good shape for their age and still enjoying life. And for the pet tax, here are some shots of them down at Spanish Banks Park and beach, enjoying the spring weather. Look at
them. I always love these pictures. So,
the
so
fluffers.
Good.
Thank you for that, James. Awesome.
All right. This one's from Anonymous, pronounced she and her. And it begins with, I owe Dana an apology. I discovered the show near the beginning, and it helped me survive the prior administration by validating my rage and sadness. But I was disappointed to lose the more radical voices of the younger co-hosts. I even wrote in to complain that an old white woman in my 50s, I needed ideas from people less like myself. Now, I didn't know at the time how much Dana would become a... I better not start crying. I might start crying. I didn't know how much Dana would become a comfort to me. I have a young adult son who's on the autism spectrum and almost paralyzed by anxiety. He's been in counseling for years and has recently come to recognize himself as asexual and non-binary. He still uses male pronouns because he has only been comfortable coming out to me, to his counselor, and on his state ID card. This is a heavy secret to carry. And I worry, like my child does, about the reactions of family members who I trust will not love him less, but may not say the right things to begin with. Thank you, Dana, for your passionate and compassion. I feel less alone when I see so many good people fighting for their acceptance. For my pet tax, here's a photo of my very elderly cat, Milkshake. He was named after the cat on Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy. In younger years, he was a willing participant in wrestling matches with a pit bull puppy and Pokemon training from my boys. Now he calls the shots, tells us when and where he needs food, water, and a lift onto the couch. We know he won't be with us much longer, but we want to spoil him as long as possible. An anonymous, thank you for that. I know that I bring a different voice to the beans than some of the younger hosts, Jordan, and I know people that came before me, but I'm glad that I've been able to at least bring you some comfort and fill a void that maybe you didn't know you had until now. So thank you for that. It is always so nice to hear when you have a good effect on another human being. So I appreciate it.
That's awesome. And look at this baby. What a sweet baby.
I know. What breed of cat is this? Because they're adorable, like these little short, fluffy-haired ones.
It looks like a...
I mean, I may not know.
I'm going to get it wrong.
That's
it looks
okay.
like a Scottish fold, but I could be very wrong.
All right. Well, either way, I really like these kind of cats. They're very cute.
They're beautiful. Thank you for that. Thank you for that very much, Anonymous. I appreciate that. Next up from Mike from Ohio, pronouns he and him. Sorry, Mike, about Ohio. My cat is bullying me, says Mike. Every day for the last week, my cat Pippin has come into my office. I work from home, screaming. I give him some pats and he's still not happy. He's got food in his bowl, so it isn't that. Then, in desperation, I lie on the bed on my back and he climbs onto my chest and he's quiet. Photo of the attached result.
Oh.
He just wants cuddles.
He just wants cuddles.
I'm going to hit this next one too and then we'll get on to the next.
You go for it.
Next couple. From Anonymous, pronouns she and her, I was so excited to hear about the party heading to Niagara Falls, New York, of course. I was born and grew up there. I suggest a 3-mile walk around Goat Island to feel the mist and even touch the mighty Niagara Falls,
ooh,
which is actually three falls, Horseshoe Falls, also known as the Canadian Falls, America Falls, and Bridal Veil Falls. From the Canadian side, if time permits, you can see the panoramic view and lights at night. Happy travels.
Love it. I love all this. All right. This is from Anonymous, pronouns she and her. Young activist good news. Hello, awesome humans of the beans. I am a teacher. On Friday, high school students around the country, they stood up and they walked out of class over the leaked SCOTUS decision and the attempts to overturn Roe. And we're going to include a link in the show notes for this. And this was the Denver Metro High School students walk out school to advocate for abortion rights. This is the link in the story. It's from the Colorado Public Radio. We'll make sure that's in the show notes for the patrons. I feel like this hasn't gotten nearly the attention it deserves and hoped you would highlight it. And we are. I walked out with my students yesterday and I'm so fucking proud of them while also being profoundly sad that their rights are under attack again. Most of them can't vote yet and they deserve a better future than this. I've included a couple of photos of some of the posters.
All right. So here's the first sign. It's a wire hanger with a circle and a line through it. And it says, keep your law out of our uterus. And then here's another one that says, keep your bands off my body. And there's some, we had such an incredible showing up of people this weekend on the 14th. And these signs are amazing. And I love these high school students just walking out in protest. It's incredible. So hats off to the activists, the young activists. And finally, from Dennis, pronouns he and him. Greetings all. Not a listener from the kitchen days, but I remember listening when Mandy and Jordan co-hosted. The Beans is the first podcast I listen to daily, even before Rachel. Oh my God.
Woo.
We loved Wednesday's interview with Steve Pearson, but my wife wants to know who Howie Wynn is.
That's funny. This is Howie Wynn.
Not really. She's the smartest person in the world, but I know I almost drove the car off the road laughing when she said it.
That's really funny. Who's Howie Wynn? This is Howie Wynn.
Yeah. Everyone, I'd like you to meet Howie Wynn.
Awesome.
Thank you for that, Dennis. And thanks to everyone for your submissions. We really appreciate them. Keep them coming. You can submit your good news, corrections, confessions, opinions, whatever you want to send to us. You can do so by going to dailybeanspod.com and click on contact. And that's this is how you do it. I don't know why
this
that...
is how you do it.
Okay, so Dana, any final thoughts?
No, I think that was enough. Actually,
that was that's quite enough.
That's quite enough. Yep, that was quite enough singing for the end of the podcast for me.
All right, again, all of my love and support, and there aren't even words. Do you know what I mean, Dana?
I do.
Like, and use these words so often that they feel empty now. And I just don't know how to express my sorrow and sadness and support for everyone in who are victims, family members, communities of these mass shootings this weekend.
And I want to say this, and it's not even just the victims and the communities. It's and I hope I'm okay saying this as an ally, and I try and walk the walk and practice not just, you know, not being racist, but practice actively being anti-racist. It's not just the communities that were directly affected. The Black community is hurting in general. And this is all over the country. And all Black people, trans Black people, cis Black people, LGBTQ Black people, straight Black people. This isn't just the communities that were involved in this shooting. This was a racially motivated crime. And when that happens, it affects everyone that belongs to the periphery of that community. And so please just know that that's who I'm thinking about. All of you, my friends, my family, those people I love, the people I have not ever met. And I'm sorry that you continue to carry this burden in this country. It breaks my heart. But just know that I am thinking of you. And I hope that if you'll send in, you know, emails to the Beans, and even if it's just venting, but you'll call someone if you're hurting and you have some support and someone to talk to. Just know that we love you.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Dana. Absolutely. And with that, we will be back tomorrow. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking with Jen Budd. She's a former Border Patrol agent, now immigration activist. Her new book is out, and we're going to talk to her about that. So until then, please take care of yourselves, take care of each other, take care of the planet, take care of your mental health. And please vote blue over Q. I've been AG.
And I've been DG.
And them's the Beans. The Daily Beans is written and executive produced by Allison Gill, with additional research and reporting by Dana Goldberg and Amy Carrero. Sound design and editing is by Desiree McFarlane, with art and web design by Joel Reeder with Moxie Design Studios. Music for The Daily Beans is written and performed by They Might Be Giants, and the show is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, please visit mswmedia.com.
MSW Media.
They Might Be Giants have been on the road for too long.
Too long.
And They Might Be Giants aren't even sorry.
Not even sorry.
And audiences like the show's too much.
Too much.
And now They Might Be Giants are playing their breakthrough album, Flood.
All of it.
And they still have time for other songs.
They're fooling around.
Who can stop They Might Be Giants and their liberal rock agenda?
Who?
No one. This ad was paid for with somebody else's money.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.